Welcome to The Debate. If we successfully stop global warming and, you know, we manage to equalize wealth across the planet, but we utterly destroy local communities and irreplaceable ecosystems just to dig up the lithium and copper to do it, did we actually win?
Yeah, that is the exact uncomfortable reality we are looking at today.
It really is. Today, our discourse centers on a critical 2026 white paper by Bechara Sahali. It's titled Beyond Global Justice Toward a Life-Coherent Architecture of Universal Provisioning.
Quite a mouthful, but a very important paper.
Definitely. And this paper is a direct, aggressive, and honestly highly constructive response to the monumental Global Justice Report that came out recently.
Right.
That original report gave us a highly quantified mathematical blueprint for exactly how to compress global wealth, converge incomes, and rapidly decarbonize the planet.
And it did so beautifully, I might add.
It did. It was mathematically brilliant. But I will be arguing today that Sahali is correct here. Strict numerical targets, like income convergence and carbon emission limits, they are inherently insufficient. Because when you only look at aggregate global progress, you know, the big macro numbers, you end up masking the systematic sacrifice of vulnerable populations and fragile ecosystems on the ground.
Right. And I will be taking the opposing view today, because replacing objective, enforceable economic targets with a complex, highly subjective framework, what Sahali calls, you know, life-coherent metrics, it risks severe conceptual overreach.
Okay, but
it invites paternalism and, honestly, a kind of bureaucratic paralysis that could fatally delay the urgent physical ecological action we need to literally survive the century.
Well, let's start by giving the original Global Justice Report its due, because the sheer scale of what it achieved mathematically is staggering.
Staggering is the right word.
It's a masterpiece of reverse construction. The authors essentially started at the finish line, right? A 1.8 degrees Celsius warming limit and a 60,000 euro per capita income convergence across the globe by 2100. And then they built the institutional and financial models backward to prove it was possible.
Right. And it proved that if we aggressively compress extreme wealth and democratize global ownership, we can actually fund this massive transition. It isn't just theory. It's a fully costed structural blueprint.
It is. But that brings us to the core flaw that Sahali's white paper exposes, which is the danger of aggregation.
Okay.
A macroeconomic model can look at the whole globe and say, success, we hit the 1.8 degree climate target and we equalized purchasing power. But inside that global average, you can simultaneously create what we call green sacrifice zones.
Right, the extraction zones.
Exactly. These are localized areas where minority communities or pristine watersheds are utterly destroyed to extract the raw minerals required for all those solar panels and wind turbines. The harm just, it disappears inside the improving average.
Look, I get that, but you're talking about a transition of a scale we've never seen in human history. I mean, we are talking about retrofitting the entire industrial base of the planet.
Yes, but equalizing purchasing power within an extractive system is not true justice. Sahali draws heavily on the capabilities tradition here and uses of a fantastic analogy. They write, a bicycle does not produce mobility where roads are unsafe or the person cannot use it.
Sure.
Giving everyone 60,000 euros a year means literally nothing if their local water supply is permanently contaminated by a lithium mine. We have to shift the objective from mere income convergence to what Sahali calls life capacity convergence, which is anchored by a strong civil commons floor.
See, I completely understand the philosophical appeal of that critique. It sounds incredibly humane, but I come at it from a different way. I defend the original framework precisely because of its quantitative rigor.
Even if it misses the local harm.
Because achieving 1.8 degrees Celsius and cutting average annual working hours to 1,000 by 2100, those are monumental goals. But more importantly, they are measurable, they are enforceable, they are grounded in physical and mathematical reality.
But are they sufficient?
Well, they are necessary for survival. When we start challenging those hard metrics with a qualitative framework, we run straight into what the author himself warns about, which is conceptual overreach.
Explain that a bit more.
Right, so if every preferred social outcome is suddenly labeled life coherent, and every disliked outcome is life incoherent, the framework loses all analytical meaning. By introducing highly interpretive metrics, things Sahli calls relational capacity or cultural continuity, you are inevitably inviting metric capture.
So walk us through what you mean by metric capture in this specific context.
Okay, metric capture is when the way you measure success gets manipulated by the people being measured.
Right.
If you demand that an infrastructure project satisfies a vague metric like cultural continuity, you will inevitably end up building a bloated, bureaucratic life capacity accounting authority. And that authority will spend years endlessly debating the philosophical definition of a good life, issuing massive reports, all while completely stalling the urgent physical rollout of green energy.
But
we do not have the time to philosophize our way out of the climate crisis. We have to physically build our way out of it.
I hear ya. But the way we measure success dictates what actually gets built. Let's look at how our current models operate under conventional GDP accounting, because this perfectly illustrates Sahli's point about system exhaustion. Think of GDP like a personal credit card statement.
Okay.
So if you get into a horrific car crash and you max out your credit card, paying for emergency room bills, surgeries, a totaled car, your financial activity for that month is huge. Your personal GDP is basically through the roof.
Yeah, but your actual life is terrible.
Exactly. Your actual quality of life is terrible. That is exactly how our current global metrics operate. A health system that processes an increasing amount of chronic disease, that looks like economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
An agricultural sector that boosts crop yields by entirely depleting the topsoil and polluting the local watershed, that registers as a net positive on the global balance sheet.
Right, and the original report addresses that. It addresses that by shifting the goal from raw GDP growth to carbon reduction and income convergence.
But it still relies on a fundamentally extractive calculus, just redirected toward green ends. Sahli proposes replacing this with a regenerative balance sheet. Because true prosperity requires adaptive capacity and margins.
Meaning what?
Let's look at a hospital. Spare hospital beds or distributed redundant water systems, these look like inefficiencies to a financial accountant who is optimizing for yield.
Sure.
But those exact inefficiencies are what save lives during a systemic crisis, like a pandemic or a massive drought. If our global transition relies on models that view system exhaustion as efficiency, we aren't solving the problem. We are just building a cleaner version of the exact same machine.
Look, I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Let's ground this in the physical reality of the transition. We are looking at unprecedented capital mobilization.
Massive.
The Global Justice Fund is projected to spend roughly 8 to 10% of total world GDP during the central decades of this transition. That is orders of magnitude larger than all current aid and multilateral budgets combined. We are talking about physically constructing wind farms, solar grids, mass transit systems, and water treatment plants across continents.
Right. An enormous build-out.
Exactly. So imagine a massive solar farm planned for a desert region. It needs to generate electricity efficiently to get an entire region off coal. If the funding for that solar farm is contingent on a decentralized sensing system evaluating whether it perfectly enhances the local community's cultural capacity or productive creativity,
well,
that solar farm won't get built, or it gets delayed by a decade in court. And if it doesn't get built, we don't hit 1.8 degrees.
You're assuming that universal means uniform. And that's exactly what this life capacity framework is trying to avoid.
How so?
It's not about micromanaging the placement of every single solar panel. It is about fundamentally shifting the institutional objective so that we don't reproduce the exact same exploitation we are trying to escape. Let's take the concept of temporal capacity, which just means time, treated as a distributive good.
Okay, let's look at time. The original report already addresses this. It explicitly models a reduction of working time to 1,000 hours annually for everyone. That is a concrete mathematical target.
It is a great aggregate number. But without a life-coherent lens, what does that actually look like on the ground? Getting off your shift at the solar plant early doesn't mean much if you have to spend the next 4 hours hauling safe water because the municipal pipes failed and the local ecosystem was wrecked by a mining project.
That's not exactly leisure time. A formal reduction in paid working hours could easily just transfer the burden into unpaid domestic labor, which historically, as we know, always skews heavily toward women.
Right. Life capacity ensures that the transition doesn't secretly rely on exhausted, unpaid human labor to subsidize that 1,000-hour metric.
That is a completely valid concern regarding the gender distribution of labor. But you were assuming the original Global Justice Report ignored that reality. It didn't.
It relied on the macro numbers.
I wouldn't call it vague, but let's follow your logic to its natural conclusion. What happens when these massive, necessary transition projects actively disrupt a local community? Who actually decides what gets built?
Okay, under Saheli's architecture, what happens is we strictly enforce the principle of non-sacrifice.
And what does that mean in practice?
It explicitly states that no population, no ecosystem, and no future generation should be systematically deprived of the non-substitutable conditions of life simply to provide an aggregate environmental or economic benefit to the globe. Saheli proposes a non-sacrifice review of 40.
Okay.
This isn't just a suggestion box. It would give local communities independent expertise and, crucially, the right to refuse extraction projects that would destroy their ancestral lands or permanently contaminate their fresh water.
So absolute veto power.
If a low-carbon transition is built on the systematic disposability of less powerful populations, it is a failure. If a community's core conditions of life are destroyed to dig a lithium mine, that is a sacrifice zone, plain and simple. We have to stop doing that.
Look, I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. I completely acknowledge the green sacrifice problem. Mining for renewables, the lithium, cobalt, copper, rare earth elements, it is brutally destructive.
Completely.
It tears up landscapes. It strains local water tables. It is ugly. But I have to ask you a very hard, very unforgiving question here. If we give every single local community absolute veto power over copper or lithium mining, based on their subjective definition of cultural or ecological continuity, how do we physically build the electrical grid required to hit the 1.8 degree target?
We find better ways to build it.
But subsidiarity, you know, the idea that decisions should be made at the most local level possible, is a beautiful concept only when it's balanced. If subsidiarity operates without global solidarity, local vetoes will lead directly to global climate failure.
That's a huge leap.
Is it? Let's be clear about what climate failure means. If we fail to halt warming, the resulting climate collapse will indiscriminately destroy the ancestral lands, the fresh water, and the life capacities of everyone everywhere. You cannot optimize for zero localized harm without maximizing global, irreversible harm.
See, that is the classic utilitarian trap, though. The principle of non-sacrifice does not prohibit all burdens. It doesn't claim that a global energy transition will be totally frictionless or that no one will be inconvenienced.
Okay.
It establishes a hard threshold. Cost-benefit analysis is useful, but only after we have established that an action won't push a population below a protected life floor.
But who defines the floor?
The floor is the non-substitutable conditions for life. Clean water, breathable air, safe shelter. If an extraction project permanently poisons a local aquifer, creating a situation where the community's literal survival now requires them to purchase trucked-in water they can't afford, that is an inadmissible trade-off.
Right.
What the Non-Sacrifice Review Authority does is flip the burden of proof. The global project promoter must scientifically prove they aren't causing irreversible harm.
And if they can't?
Then a life-coherent approach forces the system to innovate. It forces us to find alternatives, different battery chemistries, circular recovery and recycling of existing metals, or, God forbid, radically reducing luxury energy demand in the global north.
Right.
Rather than just taking the path of least resistance, which historically always means exploding the most politically weak, marginalized community on the map.
Forcing a redesign sounds great in a seminar, but it is incredibly difficult to enforce. When we are talking about raw material bottlenecks on a ticking clock, we are operating under severe atmospheric time constraints.
I'm not denying the constraints.
But if a massive copper deposit is located under an inhabited area, and we need that exact copper to wire an entire continent's renewable grid within a decade, waiting for speculative recycling technologies to mature is a luxury we simply do not have. Which actually brings up a massive question. Who is mediating these conflicts, and more importantly, paying for all of this? The source material talks extensively about reconstructing global public authority and finance.
Exactly. Because someone has to govern these localized trade-offs, and someone has to fund the transition without demanding extractive Wall Street-style financial returns. Sahali champions the total reconstruction of the World's Sovereign Fund.
Right.
Under the original report, this fund is projected to hold roughly 60% of world GDP.
Which is an unprecedented pooling of public wealth.
It's massive, but Sahali argues it must be transformed into a World Life Stewardship Trust. The mandate here is a paradigm shift. Financial returns must be strictly subordinated to a life mandate. The provisioning of essential global services and climate infrastructure cannot be contingent on whether it beats the stock market.
The original report already moves away from stock market logic, though.
It does, but it still uses conventional financial ledgers. Sahali goes further. The report estimates roughly 240% of 2025 world GDP is owed for historical climate damage and colonial reparations from the north to the south.
Right.
A life-coherent framework argues this staggering debt must be settled via true ecosystem restoration, technology sharing, and institutional rebuilding, not just raw cash transfers. Because raw cash transfers might just fuel inflationary consumption without actually building local resilience.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered inflation in the broader sense? Because you cannot simply mandate abundance or decree life coherence from a central authority if you ignore the physical limits of labor and materials.
Of course. Let's look closely at the falsification tests provided right there in Sahali's text. If public credit institutions, like this new stewardship trust, completely ignore yield and conventional bankability in the name of a life mandate, we risk massive economic destabilization.
How so? Because money is fundamentally just a claim on real resources. If you issue limitless global credit to fund every qualitative human capacity, if you say, we will fund everyone's cultural continuity and temporal abundance, without ensuring that the underlying productive base is expanding to meet those claims, you don't get prosperity, you get hyperinflation.
Well,
financial claims become completely disconnected from real resource bottlenecks. Let's look at healthcare. You can issue all the credit you want for a new hospital, but you cannot print a trained nurse. You cannot print a water treatment plant or the steel required to build it.
But a regenerative public finance system explicitly begins with real resource assessment. That is exactly how you avoid inflation. The paper is incredibly clear on this.
Is it?
Yes. It says you begin with the life capacity objective. What do the people actually need to survive and thrive? Then you assess the real resources and ecological constraints available. And only then do you select the financing mechanism to match. The life mandate doesn't mean ignoring physical limits. It means prioritizing how we use the limited physical resources we actually have.
But we already have mechanisms for that.
We have mechanisms that prioritize profit. Right now, conventional finance will eagerly fund luxury fossil fuel consumption or build another speculative high-rise full of empty apartments because it generates a high financial yield. Meanwhile, it starves our municipal water system in the global south because the financial return is too low.
Okay, true.
The World Life Stewardship Trust corrects that misallocation. It recognizes that preserving shared productive capacity and fulfilling universal necessities are the actual foundations of the economy. If we only fund what is strictly profitable, the extractive economy will continue to dictate the boundaries of human survival.
But wait, the Global Justice Report already addresses the allocation of capital, and it does so mathematically, without needing a subjective stewardship trust. It relies on aggressive global taxation and democratic monetary reform. It specifically outlines the creation of an international clearing union and a United Nations central bank.
Let's unpack the clearing union for a second, because that's a pretty dense concept.
Right. So The International Clearing Union is basically a system to prevent global trade imbalances from destroying poorer nations. Historically, if a developing country ran a trade deficit, they had to borrow in U.S. dollars, which forced them to gut their public sector, you know, fire teachers, privatize water, just to get the foreign currency to pay the debt.
Exactly. Classic structural adjustment.
The Clearing Union stops that. It balances the accounts globally so no country is forced into austerity just to survive in the global market.
Spot on.
Combine that with the United Nations Central Bank that taxes extreme wealth at highly progressive rates and channels it into the Global Justice Fund. That mathematically restructures the global economy. By layering Salehi's complex life capacity ledger on top of an already functioning mathematical solution, you invite rhetorical capture.
I don't see it as capture.
But how long until a state bureaucracy or a massive corporate entity simply self-certifies that their highly profitable extractive mining project is actually capacity enlarging? The original metrics, wealth distribution, carbon parts per million, hours worked, they're hard to fake. Qualitative metrics like relational capacity are incredibly easy to manipulate to justify institutional self-preservation.
And that is exactly why Saheli's framework insists on nested democracy and distributed social sensing. It explicitly does not rely on the corporation self-certifying.
Okay, but...
It relies on the workers on the ground, the local communities, and independent ecological trustees having legal standing to challenge those claims in real time. The data must be publicly intelligible, and it must be linked to an actual remedy. Our institutions have to actually look at how their policies affect real people on the ground, rather than just pointing to a global spreadsheet and saying, look, the math works.
But the math has to work or the climate collapses.
Of course. I'm not denying the math. But true global justice cannot be achieved merely by mathematically redistributing income within a broken extractive machine. If the machine still requires sacrifice zones, if it still exhausts its workers and depletes the topsoil to hit its targets, then income convergence is just a fairer distribution of the spoils on a dying planet. Institutions must be answerable to their living consequences, prioritizing a civil commons floor and the principle of non-sacrifice above all aggregate targets.
And I would summarize my position by saying that while life coherence is a beautiful, deeply humane, philosophical ideal, solving a global climate and inequality crisis requires the rigorous mathematical urgency of the original Global Justice Report.
We are up against the strict physics of the atmosphere, encumbering a functional, quantified survival plan with subjective, qualitative vetoes risks achieving neither justice nor survival. We need the physical infrastructure built, and we need the wealth transferred globally, without getting bogged down in an endless bureaucratic debate over the definition of cultural continuity.
I think where we land here is fascinating because despite our deep disagreement on the specific mechanisms of governance, I think we both strongly agree on a fundamental paradigm shift presented in both texts.
Which is?
The era of growth-mediated welfare is permanently over.
Ah, yes.
The old 20th century idea that we can just rely on aggregate economic expansion, just growing the GDP pie forever to indirectly deliver social security to everyone, that idea is dead.
Absolutely. We are in total agreement there. Both the original report and Saheli's critique agree on the concept of asymmetric sufficiency.
Unpack that term for us real quick.
Asymmetric sufficiency means acknowledging that the globe is completely unbalanced right now. The global north must radically contract its material and energy throughput. It has to use less, while the global south must be allowed to expand its material use to build the infrastructure needed to meet universal necessities.
Right.
It's an asymmetric approach to reaching a sufficient standard of living for everyone. We both agree that ecological ceilings and a strong universal floor are non-negotiable.
And we also agree on the institutional mechanisms needed to balance that power.
Yes. I will certainly grant that the sheer institutional ambition of the Global Justice Report represents a profound and necessary shift away from the old GDP-weighted global governance we have today. A perfect example is the proposed double majority voting system.
Right. This is crucial because it completely changes how global power works. Under double majority voting, a global policy only passes if it has both a majority of the world's nations and a majority of the world's population.
Exactly. It balances state equality with actual human population size. It stops five wealthy, powerful countries from dictating the economic rules to the rest of the globe, which is how the World Bank and the IMF essentially operate today.
The International Clearing Union we discussed earlier is another great example of that convergence. It's a mechanism to ensure that no country has to dismantle its healthcare or education systems just to obtain foreign currency to survive.
Both models agree on a massive structural change is needed. The disagreement is purely on how we measure the success of those structures.
And that tension we've explored today, the intense push and pull between quantifiable execution on a ticking clock and qualitative human dignity on the ground, reveals that there is far more to explore in Saheli's architecture. It asks us to look past the map and truly examine the territory, which leaves us with a lingering question to consider long after we sign off today. Even with all the wealth in the world and all the mathematical models perfectly balanced, can our institutions ever truly measure the conditions of a good life, or will the numbers always fail to capture what makes life worth living?